Hello and welcome to podcast 6 of the Falklands War series of podcasts being recorded for the PTT and SimSec. This is a amphibious command slash land warfare themed interview with Guy Sheridan, who in 1982 was the second in command of 4-2 Commando and was chosen as the Land Forces Commander for Operation Paraquet, the recapture of South Georgia, and would of course return to serve with 4-2 Commando for much of the Falklands campaign itself. This is a unique perspective on what was a small-scale amphibious assault.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
So, the first question is, what went through your mind when you were told you were going to war?
It was Nick Vaux, who was my commanding officer, 4-2 commander. I was his second in command, who called me in and said that I'd been selected. And then later, I think it was the following day, I was down in the headquarters, Commando Forces in Plymouth. While I was down there, I was sorting out logistics matters for this operation. And General Jeremy Moore called me into his office. And the reason why I mention this is that he actually said to me, apart from the pleasantries of saying hi, and because I knew him anyway, he said, as I was about to leave, he said, as you know, you've been selected to command the land forces that will repossess the island of South Georgia. He went on to say, your force will operate in great secrecy. You will be at considerable risk and far from military support. And then he followed up with two words, which is always the follow-up, good luck. And I suppose I could say that after that statement, then I realized that we were going to do a very risky operation, and that it was a small amphibious style of operation, and if it went wrong, the focus would certainly be on me. So I was pretty apprehensive about that side of it. From the side of view of going to war, no, I wasn't apprehensive. I'd had bags of active service experience in the Dhofar War in the late 60s in Muscat and Oman. So I wasn't worried about the action because I knew how to handle all that myself. It was just the fact that I was going to be in command of a landing force with all the risks attached to it of landing in a pretty hostile place in pretty awful weather that was a bit I was a bit apprehensive about that. I wasn't apprehensive about the scene down in South Georgia because I'm a mountaineer. I just come back from northern Norway with the commando after 3 months of Arctic training, literally a week before we set sail for the Falklands, for South Georgia. We'd just come back from northern Norway, so we were pretty fresh on mountain and Arctic operations. So what South Georgia could throw at us in terms of weather once we were ashore, I wasn't concerned. I wasn't unhappy about that at all. I think my main apprehension focused on that period of time when you launched from the ship until you arrived on shore. I think that's how I would sum it up.
And Well, you've sort of answered this question, but I'll ask it anyway, because it might produce... You might want to add some more. Did you feel trainer prepared for it when you were told you were going?
Oh, yes, and I'm what the Royal Marines called an Arctic warrior. In my whole service, I spent 18 winters in northern Norway, and at that time I'd spent about 10. My specialisation was mountain and Arctic warfare, so I felt very well prepared to do an operation of this sort in terms of my training and how to handle the weather, the terrain, and associated aspects of an operation down on that island. So, yes, I was prepared, and I was very happy with the preparation that the company had been through. After all, I'd just been with them all up in North Norway for 3 months. So I'd been through the same training that they had. Their training wasn't quite so in-depth as mine, because some had had 3 or 4 winters up in North Norway. Some had only were on their first winter. Some were on their second or even third. But even that was valuable for me to have. So I was very content that we could cope with all that, and we were well prepared for what was to face us.
Okay. Well, sort of, we covered those. You were, of course, placed in charge of the land forces for Operation Paraquet. Can you shed any light on how that force was assembled?
Well, the force came from 4-2 Commando, and it was a company group. The commanding officer resourced it, Colonel Nick Vaux, resourced it from within his command. So elements from reconnaissance, mortar, assault engineers, and the medical people all came from within the commando. So there were people we knew, and we formed a company group of about 130 strong, which was thought to be the right size force to take on what we anticipated to be the opposition in South Georgia. So when we were all formed and got ourselves organized in Bitley, we then went off to Bryce Norton, flew down to Ascension, where we got on the ship. Now, I had no idea what shipping I was going to get onto when I left UK. So when I arrived in Ascension, I had to find that out. And so in the meantime, of course, Northwood, together with Admiral Woodward, must have decided what shipping was going to go down there, and had given it enough thought to A, house a company, to have the command elements with the task group commanding ship, and so on. And in fact, that's all worked out all right. What I didn't know was that the captain of the Antrim had been made the task group commander, he had no experience of amphibious operations or training at all. He actually didn't actually understand the rank structure of the Royal Marines vis-a-vis the Army. I had a lieutenant colonel in the Royal Artillery as my gunnery, naval gunfire support officer, advisor, and he thought he was the landing force commander because he was a lieutenant colonel, and I was just a major. And he didn't understand that the Royal Marines, there is a difference between the Royal Marine ranks and the Army ranks. So that didn't help, and it was made even more confusing when the SAS pitched up on day 2 of our sail down out of Ascension. I didn't know they were going to come. And that confused the captain of Antrim even more, because there was a major in charge of the squadron of SAS, at the same rank as me, in terms of rank displayed on the shoulder. So it was difficult. That was a difficulty I could have done without.
Yeah, it would possibly what he should have been given was a manual of Royal Marine ranks and amphibious force to explain the stuff. I do sometimes think the modern Navy could do with such a manual as well.
Well, these days it wouldn't apply now, because the Royal Marines have aligned themselves to the Army rank structure. We all had, in name, we all had the same ranks before, a lieutenant, captain, a major, lieutenant colonel, and so on. But we were aligned to the naval rank structure. although we had the army nomenclature. But now it's all aligned to the army. So we are the same. But that, at this time in the Falklands, we were not the same, and we were part of the naval rank structure. And apart from that confusion, anyway, when we arrived, I wasn't surprised that there was no amphibious staff officer on Antrim, because you know, we were a small enough force that we wouldn't have warranted to have amphibious staff officers specifically placed with us to do the amphibious planning. We were too small a group, and my own experience and that of Chris Nunn's, we would muddle through any amphibious planning between the two of us. I'd had amphibious landing experience and exercises, so I knew the broad principles. Chris Nunn, as a company commander, was there for me to call on advice, and he had air experience because he was a pilot. So between the two of us, I was not surprised to know that there was no amphibious staff officer detailed to be on board that ship to help us out.
It might have been useful, though.
It could have been useful. I think latterly, when it came down to the actual landings, when they did take place, because we'd lost two helicopters on the Fortuna Glacier, Chris Nunn and I used the two pilots as staff officers to organize our flights and our schedules for the landing with the few helicopters that we were able to muster to get us ashore. So, and their experience, they didn't have any helicopters themselves to fly because they'd both crashed. So we used those two. So we were flexible and were able to do all that sort of planning within our own resources.
Okay. Moving on from that, the planning situation, how did you keep the troops sort of motivate and integrate the force, or did you not manage to integrate the force as you went south with the SAS? I believe there was also SBS and your own 4-2 company from 4-2 commando.
Well, the shipping that had been allocated for the operation consisted of Antrim, which is a guided missile destroyer, HMS Plymouth, which had was a frigate, and a submarine frigate, and a big oiler called the Tidespring, an RFA. So it made natural sense for the company to be put on the oiler, which had the space for 120 men, and for me to go on the task group commandership, together with elements that I wanted to keep near me, in particular Chris Nunn, who was going to be, although he was the company commander, was going to be involved in planning with me, so I needed to have him alongside me. For most of the time, and it was very easy for him to go over and visit his company every day by helicopter on the passage down south. And that is particularly what he did. He went and trained with his company. The Tidespring, the RFA, had the space for training, for doing mountaineering type training off the superstructure of the ship and so on. So I was very satisfied with that. The Tidespring carried two Wessex 5 helicopters, troop-carrying helicopters. So we had our assets on board where the company was, and that was an important aspect for me. It was then simply a matter of me getting a place on HMS Antrim where I could sort out an ops room and get our communications sorted out, to be alongside the captain and the task group commander, so that we could go and talk to each other and I could knock on his door at any moment. So that was all right. And that was completely screwed up when, unannounced, the SAS arrived on day two out of Ascension. Now, I hadn't been told that they were going to come to join my force. They just suddenly arrived, and the ships were overflowing before they arrived, and then to have an extra 64 people or whatever they were, we had to disperse them amongst the shipping. So the squadron commander and I think one troop arrived, or a troop and a half, stayed on Antrim, and they were all sleeping in the corridors, and the place was bulging with people. The water production facilities on Antrim could hardly cope with the demand. So whoever had sent the SAS, and I suspect it was Headquarters Special Forces, just told them to get on the shipping at all costs, because at that moment of time they probably thought that it was the South Georgia operation was going to be the only operation of the crisis, and they weren't going to miss out on that operation. But it was a damn nuisance from my point of view, because I didn't know that they were coming until they arrived. They produced all the problems of housing them, and confusion to the captain of Antrim, who didn't understand the ranks.
So, I might as well ask this question now, because it does seem to come up every time I have a podcast which involves the SAS. The satellite communication system they brought with them, how did that affect the operation?
What was annoying for me was that when these people arrived, I had to assume that they were under my command, because they came to join my landing force, albeit unannounced. But at that time, they had their own chain of command up to the top, which they jealously guarded, up to their own people in Hereford and the headquarters of Special Forces in London. I didn't discover that they had their own communications equipment until I was summoned down to a radio room one morning, and Colonel Mike Rose, who was the CO-22, asked to speak to me. He was on HMS Fairless, I think, off Ascension. And when he spoke to me, he said, "Why are you being so difficult with my squadron commander?" And I then said on the phone, "Chief, there's a bad line." I was furious, because then I knew that the squadron commander had used some private communications equipment and had gone behind my back. That was very disappointing from my point of view, and from then on, I was very reluctant to give them much leeway, much rein.
It sort of makes sense. Moving on from that, how did the operation shape up from your perspective, going south to South Georgia? How did the planning and sort of the operational, the working out of what would take place in the operation, how did that form up in your mind?
Well, I think from the outset, we began to, Chris and I began to sort of brainstorm it on departure from Ascension. And in essence, we didn't know much of what was there, so we needed to find out what was there. So that meant some form of reconnaissance before we did anything, and the results of that reconnaissance would come to me, out of which I would formulate a plan. And that was my sort of concept. So we had our own organic reconnaissance within the company group. I didn't need the SAS to do this. I didn't need the them at all. In fact, our people were much more experienced operating ashore in a mountainous environment than the SAS, who that squadron had just come back from tropical training in Kenya, for God's sake. So I didn't need these people to do my reconnaissance for me. But having said that, when they did arrive, I thought, well, we've got to use them. We're all wearing the same uniform in that sense. We're all British. We've got to work together. So reconnaissance was the first task we needed to find out where the opposition were in South Georgia. And depending on the results of that, I would make a plan. I had my assets. I had two helicopters and also the third helicopter, which could be stripped out of its anti-submarine equipment on HMS Antrim. So that was the equivalent of three Wessex helicopters. So I could get a good first wave in on a landing using those three helicopters. And it was on that sort of basis that we went south, and we did the training accordingly. And then because the SAS, their raison d'etre is reconnaissance, advanced force reconnaissance, to provide information for a commander, I thought I gave them the task to find out about the dispositions of Argentines in one area on the island, and I gave the SBS a task to find out the dispositions in another part of the island. And it was, of course, it's all history now, but the SAS decided to go and land on a glacier, and I discouraged that. I advised the captain of Antrim, the captain of Endurance said no, but the captain of Antrim had the squadron commander confidence and overruled what I said. So that landing took place, and we all know what happened. The helicopters were wrecked, so my assets were getting ashore, still lie on the glacier to this day.
I didn't realise that. I didn't realise they were still there. I thought someone might have gone and cleaned them up by now.
No, they cannibalised. They took what they could out of them before the snow covered them up, but they're now deep into the ice.
That could be a very interesting archaeological dig someday.
Yeah, that was
a bit random, I know.
Spewed out one day in 500 years' time, and everybody would think, oh, there's a new sort of penguin coming out of the glacier.
Right then. So, how did you, once you'd lost these assets, you know, this, as you had already described it, your primary first wave idea was to use those helicopters. How did you react? What did you think? How did you sort of go through the changes to sort of develop the plan to make use of, I suppose, other assets?
Well, having lost those main assets for the force to get ashore, I was confronted with a huge dilemma. We had no other assets apart from the one helicopter on board HMS Antrim, which was her own anti-submarine helicopter. And so we muddled through. We had the boat troop of the D squadron of the SAS, who had their boats with them, their little small Gemini craft, really, without boards. So I ordered the squadron commander to send them ashore to carry out the mission of the mountain troop, which was involved in the helicopter crashes. They went ashore, but they had a problem because their motors didn't work properly, and two boats got lost. We didn't really know what had happened to them. So I had to assume that the operation was compromised from that moment on. In fact, one of the boats got blown out to sea, and the other just managed to get onto one of the peninsulas and get ashore, where they holed up. I had probably about half of that troop ashore doing the job, and the other half technically were lost. So that wasn't much good. I suppose what saved everything was that the captain of Antrim got information from London that an Argentine submarine was around. And so the Antrim's helicopter was re-rigged for anti-submarine work and pinging and dropping its sonar and so on, and flew off, fortunately discovered the boat that had been blown out to sea, and winced up three very frightened SAS troopers who were vaguely, basically on their way round the world to a very unenviable death. And just in the nick of time, they were picked up. The other crew went ashore, and we didn't know where they were until after the successful occupation of King Edward Point. With the submarine now preoccupying the Navy entirely, the whole mission of this force was lost. The mission was to get ashore and to repossess the island. And the Navy now started doing what they were good at, which is anti-submarine warfare. And they actually forgot about the mission. So I was knocking on doors saying, come on, we must think about doing other things, not chasing submarines. I'd actually flown on board HMS Endurance to ask him if he was prepared to put the bow of his ship on the rocks at Hope Point, at King Edward Point, so that my people could go down on ropes onto the shore. And that would be one way of getting people ashore. And he was delighted. He said, yes, of course I will put my reinforced bow on the rocks. So that was an option that I've kept up my sleeve. And it was not really until the submarine was sighted on the 25th of April on the surface and was attacked by the Antrim's helicopter that that we were able to seize a moment and formulate a very hasty plan to get ashore quickly while the submarine was being attacked, and in fact the submarine, as you know, limped back into the port of King Edward Point, and I wanted to get ashore quickly before they reorganized. And now, with the crew of the submarine adding another 75 people to the opposition, I needed to get in there quite quickly to take the place before they provided even more fierce opposition. And so I made a plan. I had had very few people. The Navy had dispatched the RFA over the horizon to get it away from the submarine, without a single word of discussion with me or the company commander. At the flick of a switch, Captain of Antrim had sent the main landing force over the horizon, so I couldn't use those. So I was left with a hotspot of people on board Antrim, I think I was able to muster something like 72 people out of the military folk on HMS Antrim, including the ship's detachment. So I pleaded for the ship's detachment. That gave me 10 more men. They were reluctant to release them because they formed part of the ship's crew. But I did get them in the end. And then I had difficulty getting into the captain's cabin because he'd called the captains of the other ships in for debriefing after the helicopter had attacked the submarine, instead of concentrating on the mission, which was to get ashore and repossess the island. And I spent 3.5 hours knocking on his door, and three times I went there, and I said, we've got to go now. And I was told in polite terms to F off three times. And so he'd lost the whole mission, and ultimately, with the daylight running out, I said, if we don't go now, we can't do it because we'll run out of daylight. And he then said, okay, go ahead. And then we went ahead, and I gave hasty orders using the 72 men that I could muster on board Antrim. We landed and we did the job. We repossessed the island and took 137 prisoners.
Did it very well. What do you think was the impact of retaking South Georgia?
Well, from my point of view, I knew that it was a very risky operation, and had there been opposition, as General Derry Moore had said, you will be far from military support. I knew that it was the first operation of the crisis, and it had to be a success. If it had been a failure, we didn't even count it as failure. It had to be successful. But it was so close to failure because of the difficulties that I had with the Navy, the command situation. It was so close to failure, and then I don't know how things would have happened with the main Falklands campaign. The ships were mustering up in Ascension. I don't know what would have happened there had we been unsuccessful. What I did know is the focus would have been on me.
And of course, you then, after Operation Paraquet, after you'd retaken South Georgia, set that up, you had to leave Chris Nunn and M Company behind, didn't you, and went off and rejoined with 4-2 Commando.
Yes, I left Chris and his company there, and left for the Falklands, and the Commando was ashore by the time I got there. It took me 11 different ships to get into San Carlos, because each ship myself and my radio operator went to, its orders were changed, and I had to transdeck to another ship that was going in the vague direction of the Falklands. And on the 11th ship, I was transferred to one that was going into San Carlos, and it happened to be the Norland. In fact, both my radio operator and I were flown to the helicopter pad on the Norland, which I think had the Gurkhas on board, members of the 5 Brigade Force anyway. When we landed on the flight deck, we were surrounded by a platoon of Gurkhas on the flight deck who were pointing their weapons menacingly at me and my radio operator. And then we were manhandled and bundled into a corner. And I called for the British Gurkha officer and I said, "Get your hands off us. What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, we've just been told that two prisoners were being delivered to the flight deck." So I was pretty miffed about that, although I could see the funny side of it afterwards. And then later that day, we were in San Carlos. I went to HMS Fearless. I left quite a lot of my kit there, and then took a helicopter forward to Teal Inlet, where the brigade had already established its headquarters. And then I flew forward to Mount Tallinter to rejoin Colonel Nick Vaux and the commando. So that's how I managed to get back. I then tried to make a case for M Company to be relieved by 5 Brigade, to get M Company up to join the commando for the main Falklands campaign. But the operation in the Falklands was too far advanced for that to happen. Chris, unfortunately, stayed garrisoning South Georgia for the duration of the campaign.
What was your experience of that campaign once you'd gone and rejoined 4-2 Commando? What, you know, the battles that took place in the advance on Stanley?
Well, rejoined the commando and we took up my position as the second in command. So I was the CO's deputy, and so if anything happened to him, I would have taken over the commando. And you sit in the commanding officer's pocket, and you share all the planning, so that when the operation started, the attack started, he was forward from me. We were never in the same place together, just in case something happened to him, so I could go forward and take over command. So I was involved in all the planning processes with my CO, and during the night attack, I was a tactical bond behind him with my team to take over in case something happened to him.
Okay. And, well, I think this is as good a point as any to get to it. What lessons or understanding that you learnt during the war would you have liked to know before the war began, and would you like to make sure that, you know, future officers know before they find themselves in similar circumstance?
Well, I think if it had been a little bit more thought put in by Fleet Headquarters in Northwood to air ship that was capable, that was used to amphibiosity, a captain and a ship that was used to amphibious operations and dealing with the Royal Marines. So they knew who we were, what we were capable of, how we lived on ships and so on. Which, in the case of us and Antrim, didn't actually happen. There was a ship that had never seen Marines on board, worked with amphibious people, although it had a Royal Marine detachment on board. And the captain had no idea about it. So I think selecting a guy for an amphibious operation and with a ship with the right guy, experienced guy, would be essential for future operations such as this. To get the chain of command so that any attached forces that arrive out of the blue understand who is in command and that they don't have their own private communications to their own command set up back in back wherever, in London or in England. And that was frustrating and a nuisance as far as I was concerned, and something that I could have done without, because it had me thinking too much about what they were up to, what they were doing, what they were conspiring between them behind my back. And you don't want to have that sort of stuff when you're supposed to be together to do this job together. And we didn't want to have infighting between ourselves. We should have had that consolidated, joined up force to fight the enemy, not ourselves. I think we had the right force strength. I think we were resourced well to do that particular job. We didn't need these extra forces that arrived out of the blue. So I think from that point of view, there was not much to learn. I think I now understand that the command and control of the SAS is very much more refined now than to what it was in those days. And they don't have the leeway and the rein that they had in 1982.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking part.